everybody. Welcome to Airy Live. I'm Mark Tier, the founder and CEO at Black Spectacles. I'm joined with our producer, Patrick Finnegan, and architect, Garrick Baker, who is going to review several project management mock exam questions today. We're going to go through questions that cover PJM knowledge and skills related to the difference in contract types, in architect's liability for contractor recommendations, responsibility for hazardous conditions, and firm billing rate calculations. Man, that's a bunch of meaty stuff. So it's going to be a good one today. If you're joining us for the first time, Black Spectacles is a leader in ARE prep. We work with learning scientists and architects to ensure you're studying the right content and that you retain it so that you pass the ARE on the first try. We built everything that you need to pass the exams, including new video lectures with motion graphics and 3D animation, practice exams that are as close to the real thing as you can get, flashcards, quizzes, and virtual workshops, and they're all built upon a curriculum that ensures you're learning the right content. And they all work together with our custom-built platform to ensure that you retain the information so you remember it for the exams. That's why our pass rates are 50% higher than the national average and why our members report passing in half the time of the national average. So if you want to learn more about blackspectacles.com, if you want to learn more, visit blackspectacles.com. I'm going too fast here. If you're ready to start studying, stick around to the end so you can take advantage of our discount for individual memberships. Also, we recently relaunched our PA course with all the aforementioned improvements and so forth. So take a look at PA. Also, I was just talking with Patrick and we realized, you know, we have all these social accounts and we're doing all this stuff on it and we don't even tell you about them. So over on Instagram, TikTok, and Facebook, we regularly post mock exam questions, as well as Patrick and I are working up a whole new series. We call it Licensure Stories, coming out. In fact, Patrick's probably going to beat me up for mentioning this so early, but I think it's coming out in probably a couple of weeks here. So if you don't already follow us, I suggest that you do. We're on Instagram, we're at black.spectacles. Same on TikTok and on Facebook, we're at Black Spectacles. So whatever your favorite social platform is, follow us there. And you'll get all the free content that we post regularly over there. Our next ARE Live episode will be May 23rd of 2024, where we'll be covering a PPD mock exam. If you'd like to go ahead and get yourself locked and loaded for that one, you can go to blackspectacles.com/podcast to sign up. As a reminder, we offer our referral program for firms and schools. If you introduce us to your boss or HR, and if they sign up, we'll give you a $250 gift card. To participate, follow the instructions on blackspectacles.com/group-referral. We're going to be engaging exclusively today on our online ARE community. So head over to community.blackspectacles.com and right at the top, you'll see we've pinned a thread called ARE Live PJM Mock Exam 2024. If you have a question as we're going through ARE Live today, post your question there and we'll answer your question. So I'm actually gonna be tuning in and listening to and sort of observing the questions that show up there. And then I'll any relevant questions, I'll lob those over to Garrick while we go along today. And as a special bonus, everyone who posts in that thread today will be eligible to win a free Black Spectacles t-shirt. Literally, all you have to do is go to community.blackspectacles.com into that post and say hi, and boom, you're registered. Of course, don't forget to stay tuned until the end of the episode to find out if you've won. So with that, let's get to it. I'd like to welcome today's guest, Garrick Baker. In addition to working with us here at Black Spectacles, Garrick is an architect based in Kansas. I'd like to welcome you today, Garrick.
Yeah, thanks, Mark. And be sure to enter my name into the drawing for the free t-shirt there. But just as we get started here, folks, we're going to go over a summary of topics here. So on today's session, we'll be featuring a PJM mock exam that covers the following topics: difference in contract types, architect's liability for contractor recommendations, and then responsibility for hazardous conditions, and then firm billing rate calculations. And just kind of as a heads up, all of these questions are based off of real life examples. So we may be studying for the exam, but then how do we actually apply those in real life? So hopefully you'll get a sense of that as we go through some of our content today. So what we're going to look at first here: an important part of managing any project is knowing which delivery method is the appropriate method for the client, the architect, and the contractor. One of the key indicators is when the contractor becomes involved in the process, but it also has major implications in understanding our liability and how some methods increase or decrease our responsibility to the project. With that, let's look at some of the most common delivery methods we have. So the first one, the contractor and owner into a contract, and the contractor hires the architect as a subcontractor. So this one, our agreement type, this is gonna be a construction manager at risk or contractor as constructor. A lot of times you'll hear these as CMAR or CMC. It can also be done as a design build agreement. So the typical contracts are the A132 between the owner and the contractor. And we see this as the standard form of agreement between owner and contractor with the CMAR as our advisor on that. Once their contract is signed, the contractor then enters into the agreement, the B143, with the architect. So this is the design builder architect agreement. For the design build model, the owner and contractor enter the B141 agreement, which is our agreement between owner and design builder agreement, which is then followed by the same B143, which we use for that CMAR. So why would we use a project agreement like this? The contractor and owner both now have more liability, and our client essentially becomes the contractor. So while the owner ultimately makes all the decisions, the guidance comes from our general contractor in terms of our design and deliverables. The contractor enters the project very early in the design process and prior to any formal agreement between the architect and the owner. So anytime we see these on our exams, we really want to see when exactly that contractor comes into the whole planning process. So we know if that contractor's there from the very get-go, we're looking at possibly a CMAR or that design build. So then let's look at our second one. So the owner retains the services of an architect directly and enters into an agreement to bid a project. So this is the typical design bid build or DBB model. Our contracts for such an agreement are the B101, and that's our very standard owner architect agreement, or the B102, which is the standard form of agreement with the owner and the architect. They're kind of the same, but then there's also some additional language in there, but they all essentially do the same. And then the B104 is another version of that standard form of agreement, where the owner enters into an agreement with the architect in the initial stages, which is then followed by a separate agreement with the contractor once the project has been bid. So this is the most traditional method for many reasons. This fosters a great working relationship between the owner and the architect, where the owner learns the competency level of the architect and gains trust in allowing them to make decisions on their behalf. Another positive aspect of the delivery method is that it encourages competitiveness while also allowing everyone the ability to bid on the project. This is the most useful for government entities where they need to spend the least amount of taxpayer dollars to complete the best project. So the contractor here enters the sequence later in the project lifespan and is an entirely separate agreement with the owner. Looking at our third one here, the owner hires the architect to create a project with more than one bid package. So this is known as the multiple prime contractors or MPP delivery method. The owner will enter into agreements such as the A101, and this is our standard form of agreement between owner and contractor, the A102, which is an agreement with a GMP or guaranteed maximum price, and then the A201, which is our typical general conditions of the contract. This method has many positive attributes, but also some that can have negative consequences on the project. The model is typically used when projects are overly complex or need to be completed in a shorter time frame. So this opens the door for the architect taking on additional liability in managing multiple bid packages, as well as adding more layers of coordination and communication. However, the project can move quickly by having specific areas defined prior to ladder components and being constructed earlier in the process. So the contractors typically enter the bidding phase for at least one package. As more packages are bid, more contractors are brought into the project, and each will have their own individual contracts. And then our final one here. So our final delivery method is where the owner, architect, and contractor all enter a single contract for a method known as Integrated Project Delivery, or IDP. Contracts associated with this method include the A195, and that's an owner-contractor integrated project delivery contract. The A295 are the general conditions for IPD, or the B195, which is our owner-architect agreement for IPD. So the idea is that all three parties take on equal liability for the project. However, the architect will increase their liability to take on that of the owner and the contractor. The architect will now be responsible if the owner doesn't pay the contractor or subcontractors, or is liable for any on-site injuries of the contractor. All of this unnecessary liability could potentially cost the architect in losses or damages, and at the very least would result in paying higher insurance premiums for the added liability. The contractor here enters this method in much the same way as our design, build, or CMAR process, that the GC will enter into the original agreement with the owner and architect. Okay, so now that we kind of know what methods we could possibly use to bring into our projects, let's go ahead and take a look at question number two. So you have been hired by a private company to provide architectural services for a new building. During the initial planning phases, it was determined that a site survey would need to be conducted. The owner asked for a recommendation and you provided the name of one firm. You also encouraged the owner to contract with them directly. During construction, a worker accidentally damages an underground electrical line. The worker was thus injured in the process and now has brought a claim against the owner. So the owner intends to bring a claim against your firm. Is the architect responsible for the error? So we have four options here. No, the contract was between the owner and the firm conducting the survey. Therefore, there is no liability on behalf of the architect. B is no, information provided by the owner should be reliable and deemed accurate by the architect. Therefore, the error was not caused by the architect. C, yes, the architect only provided one firm name, which was then taken as a recommendation by the owner. Or D, the architect is an integral part of the team and thus shares some of the responsibility. So this one is a bit tricky, and the answer will actually be C. But before I get into that one, let's take a look at A and B, because they could potentially actually work as well. A is incorrect, but the statement is true in that there exists no direct link between the architect and the surveying firm. However, when the architect only provided one name, the owner relied on that information to hire the firm and creates an appearance of liability. And then B is also incorrect. So again, this statement is also true. According to our B101 documents, the site should be delivered to the architect by the owner and can be deemed true and accurate. Any errors are thus the responsibility of the owner and the surveying firm. However, much like the explanations above, the single reference can create an appearance of liability. So now let's look at C and why that one was correct. So while A and B are both true, the architect had only provided one firm name for the owner to consider, which could be misconstrued as a recommendation. To avoid any appearance of liability, providing more than one firm provides the owner with options. So this returns that liability back to the owner because they ultimately determined the firm. And then let's look at D as maybe one of our incorrect answers here. So based on the reasoning in the answer, it would suggest that some form of binding agreement has been made between all three parties, the owner, architect, and surveying firm. However, in this instance, the owner contracted directly and the liability then resides on the owner and survey firm alone. So kind of looking at some of the goals for this question and these types of answers particularly. So the purpose of this question is to layer two concepts together. We're looking at risk management and services provided by architects and owner's consultants. So here's how we're addressing both. Our reference that we're going to use is the Architect's Handbook of Professional Practice, which indicates the standard B101, and you can look at the 2007 or 2017 form that anticipates that the architect's services include the usual and customary structural, mechanical, and electrical engineering services required for the project. It continues, users should note that civil engineering, a site-related service, is not included. So under the agreement, the owner is responsible for site investigations. The rationale is that, after all, it is the owner's property. And there can be serious consequences if there is an error in the survey or subsurface investigation reports. And then if we look at kind of the second component that we're layering in here, risk management is covered by the Architect's Handbook of Professional Practice, where it notes that, astoundingly, 93% of all claims comes from one of four categories. So these areas are communication, project team capabilities, client selection, and then negotiation and contracts. So within this chapter 16, risk management, we learn that proper scope falls under the effectiveness of many of these categories. We need to communicate our scope and what is covered clearly and effectively, team capabilities to fulfill the scope, and then the client's understanding of what is being provided. And then the scope needs to be defined within the negotiation and contract phase. So as the Architect's Handbook of Professional Practice pretty much summarizes all of this, is unclear scopes can make architects responsible for the performance of someone not under their direct control. So answers A and B help in addressing the initial point of adhering to the basic, usual, and customary services. However, answer C covers both the basic services and knowing how to manage the risk associated with accepting any services not under the architect's control or responsibility entirely. So that one's pretty heavy topic there. And yeah. Mark, do we have any questions or anything coming in on that?
Yeah, great question. Thanks for asking. First of all, no, I don't have any right now. We did have a small typo in the prior slide, so it should have said IPD instead of IDP, but no big deal. We fixed that one. But no other questions. So again, if anyone has any questions, feel free to post your questions in the whatever post over on community.blackspectacles.com for today's episode. But have at it. Thanks, Garrick.
Okay. All right, so let's go over to question number three here. So during the renovation of an existing building, the contractor finds that there is mold growing inside the wall cavities around the shower units. The growth is deemed hazardous and the contractor directs his team to stop work immediately until the mold has been remediated. Who is responsible for coordinating the remediation of the conditions? So is it A, the architect, B, the owner, or C, the contractor? So the answer for this one is going to be B, the owner. And let's look at first some of our incorrect ones before we get to that correct answer. So the architect would be incorrect. Hazardous materials are not considered the responsibility of the architect. The architect lacks the specific requirements and knowledge to correctly remediate the conditions and should not direct the endeavor in any way. So then the contractor is incorrect. So while the contractor is responsible for maintaining the safety of the job site, remediating existing conditions falls outside of that scope of safety. The owner has the responsibility to provide safe work environments for those they bring to the site. So that kind of brings us back here to be the owner as our correct answer. So like some of the explanations in question one, the owner is responsible for delivering, or question two rather, the owner is responsible for delivering the site in a safe and accurate manner to both the architect and the contractor. Failure to do so could result in errors or unhealthy working conditions. And this is determined in both the B101 and the A201. So again, we're going to look at kind of what was the goal of this question. So much like the second question, we're evaluating the same notion that the owner is responsible for any pre-existing site conditions. However, this is taking into consideration a site condition that is discovered during the construction phase. So we can use our process of thinking from question two to note that neither the architect nor the contractor are responsible for site conditions that fall outside of the scope of any agreements. We can also parse through some of the definitions of site safety. So hazardous existing conditions versus hazardous working conditions. So the owners provided all teams with the property with hazardous materials in this scenario, rather than we find that the contractor is not managing the construction in a safe manner. So this helps us to clarify and know the difference between what is under the control of the owner and what is under the control of the contractor. Okay, so let's go ahead and move on to question number four here. So in operating a firm, developing a profitable billing rate is necessary to maintain healthy cash flow and sustainability of the firm. Considering the following, determine the billing rate of a staff architect within your firm. So here we're looking kind of back onto maybe like the previous year's income and expense reports. So our annual revenue is $750,000, annual expenses of $670,000, and then the firm employs five staff architects. And then typically whenever we're taking our exams, if there's anything like a standard number, they should call that out for you. They're not going to make you memorize it or anything like that. So here they're telling us, use the basis of 2,080 available working hours for a single year. So we have three parts to this question. What is the minimum hourly billing rate for a single staff architect? What is the minimum hourly expense rate for a single staff architect? And then three, what is the profitability rate of a single employee? So let's go ahead and take a look at kind of number one in our question there. So the way we're going to do this is we're going to divide the annual revenue, the $750,000, by the number of employees for a total of $150,000 and generated revenue for each individual staff architect. So all we're doing here is we're taking our overall income, divide it by how many folks we have, and that'll give us just an average of how much each employee is bringing in. The next step is to then divide the revenue generated by the available working hours that can be billed. So again, we're looking back at that 2,080 hours. So this equation would be 150,000 divided by 2,080 hours for a total of $72.12, or $72 per hour. Again, whenever you're taking your exams, they may have you round up to the next dollar or the nearest dollar or something like this with some degree of leniency. So we're going to use $72 per hour here. So our answer to this number one is we can reasonably determine that the billed rate, if billed at 100% efficiency, to be $72 per hour. And whenever I say 100% efficiency, that means that 100% of everybody's available working hours are billed. And naturally, every firm, everybody has different efficiency rates. So half the time you may be out marketing, or half the time you're in meetings, and then the other half you may actually be in production. So this is just using that round 100% number in there just for clarification. So then let's take a look at number two. So we're going to work through hourly expense rate. So we're going to divide the annual expenses, so our $675,000, by the number of employees again, so number five, for a total of $135,000 in expended capital for each employee. So this includes components such as salaries, your insurance, benefits, overhead, anything you spend on the firm or operating a business, that all goes into this and gets divided by the total number of employees. So the next step is to divide the annual extended capital, $135,000 per employee, the average available working hours of 2,080 for a single year. So this results in a total of $64.90, or if we're going to round up, $65 per hour expended. So we know that the amount spent for a single staff architect is roughly $65 per hour. All right, so then hopefully our firm is running in the black and we're maintaining our profits. So let's go through our profitability rate. So the equation to find the profitability of a single staff architect would take the annual revenue generated, so we're looking at $72 per hour, and then divided by the average hourly amount expended, $65 per hour, for a result of 1.10. So from there, we're going to subtract that one, giving us an answer of 0.1, or equivalent to 10% profit per employee. And I will note here, so with our kind of professional backgrounds and everything, the AIA is a professional organization that cannot discuss pricing structures or fee amounts collectively. And of course, here we are doing a podcast, so we're talking collectively, but this is considered price fixing and is a chargeable offense. However, in broad terms, how to calculate those rates can be discussed. So the overhead, salaries, income generated, all of that is going to vary firm to firm, person to person. So we're not sitting here saying that we are fixing these fees or costs or anything like that. We're just going through the process of how we might determine those. So let's take a look. Oh, go ahead.
No, go right ahead. I wasn't sure if you were done.
Okay. So I just want to go through a little bit of the goal for why we maybe needed to look at this this question here. So part of effectively managing a project is making sure that the firm does so in a profitable manner to ensure full staffing throughout the lifetime of the project development. So this method of calculating the hourly rates for project staff can be found in Paul Siegel's book, Professional Practice, A Guide to Turning Designs into Buildings, which is a primary source of information for NCARB in drafting ARE questions for at least three divisions, so construction and evaluation, practice management, and then project management. And just kind of this question here was drawn specifically from Siegel's Chapter 6, Fees for Architect Services. So I would highly recommend maybe acquiring that book and going through it, just because there's a lot of great content in there and helps us look at some of these questions. So we can use this question to help us understand three components that go into operating a firm: income, expenses, and profit. So in the initial question, we had to determine how much income the firm was generating and then divided that amongst the team because it operates as a singular entity. So this is the quickest way to establish how much each employee is bringing into the firm. So this accounts for more of the human or employee capacity of operating a firm. The expenses, on the other hand, are more transactional in nature and consist of purchasing things like software, insurance, utilities, and anything like that. So all of these components are more materialistic in nature and often lean towards a fixed amount every month. So these are costs that we generally cannot change or modify, as there is a certain threshold that needs to be paid in order to operate the firm. Minimizing expenses as much as possible allows a firm to operate in a lean manner that reduces waste as best as possible. So the profitability of the firm comes down to how the two components above balance one another. So the employee capacity, which would consider the efficiency of the employees, marketing capabilities, when bringing on new clients and projects, all impact how much revenue is generated and how many hours are actually billed. However, the employee capacity for spending should also be considered. So those who exhibit restraint in their spending habits can help lower those expenses. Coupling this with high efficiency and steady workload produces more revenue with fewer expenses, leading to higher profitability within the firm. So a lot of heavy content there, and I imagine we maybe have a question or two now.
Yeah, I appreciate that, Garrick. So a couple quick questions. You mentioned a book reference as you were talking about 4C. What was the book that you mentioned again?
That is going to be Paul Siegel's Professional Practice. It's a guide to turning designs into buildings. And if you want to kind of look for some of those other references, NCARB has updated their ARE guidelines or handbook, whatever they call it, on their website. And you can navigate through, and they've really simplified all of those study resources pretty well. And they literally give you kind of the books that they're pulling some of these examples and questions from. So Paul Siegel, that's S-E-G-A-L, Professional Practice, A Guide to Turning Designs into Buildings.
All right, I'm trying to type it as fast as I can in into buildings. All right, good. Thank you for that one. Let's see. There was a little question about dividing by, sorry, subtracting one. If you go to 4C number 3A, there you subtracted one.
So that one, yep, that one just kind of sets our benchmark. So we could be operating at 110% or whatever, but we know that 100 is just kind of our starting point. So that's why we're subtracting that one and getting that 10% profit per employee.
Got it. Thank you. And then let's just see here. I want to make sure I've got all of them. Can we go back? I think we had two questions for question number two. So question number one here was, if the owner never asked the architect for the recommendation, would it have not been the architect's responsibility? Should the architect have told the owner they wouldn't want to provide a recommendation to avoid liability? Does that make sense?
Yep. So in this instance, we could possibly do the drawings and things without maybe that survey. That would be very risky. But in this instance, what the architect really needs to do is go back to the client and say, we need more information about the site. Do you have any site surveys, or could we request one? And at that point, then your owner needs to go out and find that civil engineer or something like that. We could also provide multiple firms. I literally just did this morning, trying to get multiple firms. So that way then the owner has some ability to make a decision versus using us as kind of that. Yes, here's a name, use them, only them. So just kind of limiting our liability there.
That makes sense. And I think there was a similar question around that. So the answer is, and again, this is a good example of how do I say it? You know, how one word in a answer or a question could sort of change the, change the meaning. So letter C, yes, the architect only provided one firm name. That one firm name was the whole sort of crux of the whole thing. If we would have said two or three, then it would not have been an issue. So awesome. I think we've gotten through all the questions that we had. So I think, I think that's it for today. So Garrick, it's been such a pleasure having you today. As always, thank you so much for your help in supporting the architecture community.
Yep. It's always fun to come back.
Awesome. All right. So just a reminder that our next ARE Live will be on May 23rd. We'll be covering a PPD mock exam. You can go to blackspectacles.com/podcast to sign up or check out the community page for this episode. Over on our Instagram, TikTok, and Facebook channels, we regularly post mock exam questions. So if you don't already follow us, I'd suggest that you do. We are at black.spectacles on Instagram and TikTok, and then just at blackspectacles on Facebook. So follow us over there. We offer a referral program for firms and schools where if you introduce us to your boss or HR, and if they sign up, you earn a $250 gift card. So to participate, follow the instructions on blackspectacles.com/group-referral. Congratulations to Baran.Karan, and I apologize if I didn't say that right. You posted on our ARE community today, and you just won a free Black Spectacles t-shirt. Or reach out via email to get your size and shipping information, so we'll be in touch soon. And just a reminder, if you'd like to be eligible to win a t-shirt, post a question that you might have in our featured topic in our community during the next ARE Live. And our community is always active. It's not just during ARE Live, so poke around and see what your peers are up to and asking about. It's designed to be a resource for you whenever you have a question. If you're joining us for the first time, Black Spectacles is a leader in ARE prep. We work with learning scientists and architects to ensure you're studying the right content and that you retain it so that you pass on the first try. As a thank you for tuning in today, we'd like to offer you a 15% discount off any membership with the code PJMLIVE15, which is valid until May 22nd of 2024. Finally, be sure to stick around for a few minutes to take our survey and share any questions you may have. I promise we read every word that you write and use them to tune our next episodes. Thanks for watching.